It's NOLA History Guy podcast for Saturday, May 4th, 2019. We're actually coming to you on Cinco de Mayo this week. Yesterday got a little crazy with things in general and did not get to record the pod on May 4th, but we're going to be consistent about the dating of the eps and, you know, just do them, yeah, say that they're every Saturday. So we're here. We're out at the PJ's Coffee on Canal Boulevard. The Crescent just went by. It's a lovely morning, and we're going to talk a little bit on our usual routine, where we're going to first talk about a Today in New Orleans History entry for the week, our pick. Actually, I've got kind of one and a half this week, but I'll explain that in a moment. And then we'll unpack a photo and look at some details in one that we've picked out for the week as well. So grab a cup of coffee or your favorite adult beverage or whatever you're drinking, and it is, you know, if you follow the vernacular, it is Cinco de Drinko right now. So go ahead and, you know, kick back and let's talk history for a little bit. So our first item up for on the pod today is going to be our Today in New Orleans history pick for the week, which there's a couple of interesting things that happened over time. It's like I wish I was older, but this week in 1962, John F. Kennedy came to New Orleans and gave a big public speech. And the photos are just incredible because it's that usual kind of Kennedy-esque sort of thing that goes on, and it's kind of neat. But I'm not going to – unpacking that or looking at that wasn't going to be something that fits what I do, so what the heck. But May 1st is a big deal in New Orleans for a couple of reasons. The politically, May 1st has always been a thing, and capitalize a thing, because it's the day that we inaugurate our mayors. Now, this is an interesting point because there was some issues with this going on last year when Mayor Cantrell was inaugurated. Mitch Landrieu was the outgoing mayor. He would serve two terms. And the election for mayor was held in November of 2017. Now, that's a normal thing to do. It's, November elections, that's common, of course, in the United States. But what's different about New Orleans is that even though the election isn't Even though the election is in November of, and it happens to be an odd year, right? You know, it was November of 5 was when Nagin got Nagin's second term. Then 9 was when it was Mitch's first term. 13 was when Mitch was reelected. And then 17 is when LaToya Cantrell, because Mitch was, you know, served his two terms, LaToya Cantrell was elected in November of 17, but she wasn't inaugurated until May 1st of last year of 2018, and that's just a normal thing. It's in the city charter. If you look at we'll put the NewOrleansPass.com, you know, the Today in New Orleans History entry for today up on the page, and one of the things there is that Campanella mentions two mayors in particular that were inaugurated on May 1st in different years, obviously, and the first of which was the earliest of which was Dellis Epps Story Morrison, Shep was inaugurated in was inaugurated in inaugurated for a recurring term in on May 1st of 1957, and then more to the point of in terms of something notable, is Ernest Nathan Morial was inaugurated on May 1st, 1978, and that's when he began his first term. Now, Dutch served two terms as mayor, and he took over, actually, from Mitch Landrieu's dad, Maurice, who is Moon Landrieu, and you get the idea. So, but the point to this being that mayors have been inaugurated on May 1st for a long, for a good long time. It's actually, well, specifically, it was basically the there was a change in the Home Rule Charter, the city charter, in 1954 that changed things over to a mayor and city council form of government, and that's to give basically create a stronger executive. And so that's kind of the idea there. So anyway, the reason I kind of point some of this out was I can there was there have been folks, and I'll just leave it at that. I don't want to get into to dumb politics, okay? But there are people that are like, Mitch Landrieu delayed leaving office so he could preside over the city's tricentennial. And I'm just like, no. Mitch Landrieu left office the same way every other mayor left office, and that's kind of how that goes. So, you know, it's just like, I'm like, you know, well, I'm reading Mitch's book right now too, and it's just some of the things are just incredible. When you start giving eighth graders death threats, it's you know, which is what happened to him. You know, that's just incredible. But this isn't that's the half, I guess, of the one and a half of today in New Orleans history, is that, you know, May 1st is inauguration day for years where we have mayoral elections, or mayoral transitions would be the better way to say it. So, but the big today in New Orleans history event or what happening took place in 1862. And in 1862, on May 1st, that's when Major General Benjamin Butler of the United States Army formally assumed control of and announced the occupation of New Orleans, and he issued a very extensive declaration of martial law. This begins this ends what I call the secession year. Now, it's a little longer than a year because the state of Louisiana secedes from the Union in January of 1861. They formally join the Confederate States of America in February of 1861. And then, of course, by April 25th of 1862, the rebel forces that remain in the city surrender to representatives of Flag Officer Farragut. And then, so that's on the 25th of April in 1862. And then on May 1st, Butler formally takes command of the city. Now, there's a lot of stuff about Butler, and we're not going to unpack all of that. We're not going to be able to address that here. You know, but I want to make two points about Butler. One, he was not a good I want to say wasn't a good man, because I can't make that judgment from this far out. He was an ambitious politician who saw the army and the war as a ticket to public office and a ticket to bigger and better things in his life once the conflict was over. So he wanted command, and he wanted fame and glory. Basically, so when the opportunity arose, basically what happened is, he's kind of a jerk, and what happens is, of course, the U.S. Army in D.C., you know, and the National Command, McClellan, and the succeeding generals that were prosecuting the war, kind of took a look at Butler, and their basic attitude was, you know, man, this guy's a jerk. And they really didn't want him around. So one of the things, one of the easy ways to get rid of Butler was to go, you know, send him on a hike. And that's essentially what they did, was to send him to command the land invasion force of New Orleans. Now, as you know, there's not a lot of land in New Orleans. And the last time an army tried to invade New Orleans, it didn't go well for them, and that was in 1815. So, but of course, the land invasion itself was only a part of this, where the British relied on just the Royal Navy dropping off the troops and moving in towards the city. The United States took a different tack and took a much, you know, broader and more aggressive approach to invading New Orleans. And that was the big, well, of course, the two big squadrons. You had Farragut with the main squadron, and then Porter with the bomb vessels squadron. And they blasted the heck out of Fort Jackson and Fort St. Philip. And that enabled, between the combination of the force that Farragut delivered with the fact that the Germans and the Irish mutinied at Fort Jackson, gave him the opportunity to get through. Now, so take a step back for a moment and just kind of visualize what would have happened, or what the timeline would have been had Farragut's crossing of the two forts not been as successful as it was. In other words, what if the garrison at Fort Jackson had fought harder, because basically two-thirds of the garrison mutinied, so the guns were not as aggressive, and the guns were basically silent on that side, and that gave Farragut an opportunity to pass the forts. So take a step back and think about if that wouldn't have happened. Certainly the squadron that ended up the next morning, you know, they talk about the 13 ships that ended up pointing all their guns at New Orleans when everyone woke up the next day. And then, and of course, Farragut's sending his officers into town to compel the surrender of the city. So that might not have gone as smoothly as it actually did. And that would have required some land support, some ground support. And the ground support was coming from 3,000 plus troops led by Major General Butler. Now, the way that the way the Union Army assembled Butler's land invasion force for the attack on New Orleans was to transport over 3,000 infantry to Ship Island, right off the coast of in Mississippi Sound, right off of the Mississippi Gulf Coast. Ship Island has Fort Massachusetts, which was a was an army garrison. It was there to defend the Gulf Coast in case of attack and invasion. It's obviously its most famous use now is to stage an invasion, because basically what the army did was they transported battalions down to Ship Island. There's some great, if in particular, LARC, the Louisiana Research Center at Tulane's library, the Howard Tilton Library. I was about to say Hogan Jazz Archive, but Louisiana Research Center has a whole bunch of correspondence, basically letters written home from men who were from the North, who were part of that detachment that went to Fort Massachusetts and then followed Butler over to New Orleans. So the idea was, what if the city didn't just wake up one morning and realize that Farragut had the capability of blowing them to bits, that it was going to be that there was actual resistance? Well, there wasn't, fortunately, because, well, frankly, Davis and his people just weren't very good at this. And so they left the city exposed. The troops were gone. Had Davis and the rebels actually left anybody other than some Creole company, militia companies that were kind of trying to find a way not to be in the war, That was about all that was defending the city. So naturally, they pretty much rolled over and surrendered when they saw the ships as well. But let's say that Lovell would have kept, Davis would have allowed Lovell to garrison the city properly and defend it. That would have meant that there would have been obviously problems for Farragut coming up the river, even though he passed the forts. And it would mean that it would have meant that Butler's detachment, Butler's 3,000 plus troops, would have had to fight to come in. They just kind of marched into the city. They came in across not too far from the Breton Sound, and came up and then slogged up the river, you know, kind of through the swamps. It's not a pleasant trip, but at least the consolation of that was that it was a slog for the infantry, but when they got to the end of that slog, there was no battle, and so that's the thing there. So, but otherwise, we could have had a massive battle that would have taken place. Certainly, the city would have encountered a good bit of damage and destruction between naval vessels and the army, and then of course the occupying army. Probably would have been a lot uglier if soldiers are having to occupy a town that just tried to kill them. But of course, that's not how it worked out, right? Farragut compelled the surrender of the city because there really wasn't anyone left to defend it or that was interested in defending it. There were defiant folks who didn't approve of their part of the rebellion ending, but well, there really wasn't a whole lot they could do about it in the face of the United States Navy and the United States Army. So Butler comes in and his forces come into the city. Farragut basically turns over the business of occupation to the army, and there's two reasons for that. One is that from reading some of Farragut's letters and his memoirs, his thoughts on things, he just doesn't seem to be suited to be the guy behind a desk that's dealing with feeding the people who haven't had jobs now in over a year and are, you know, getting pretty, you know, living pretty poorly at that point. And also the logistics of reopening the second largest port in the United States, and certainly the largest port in the South. Farragut was not suited to that. Besides, the other thing was that his actual skills were required further up the river. You know, basically, we'd rest the squadron, and then as things plan out, which of course that also becomes not part of Butler's responsibility, but part of Butler's troops' do a job in this whole thing, is that the invasion force that was staged for New Orleans did not, the occupation did not require that number of troops. So naturally, those troops, along with others that were brought in then now because the port was open to this, would come up the river, and that's where you start seeing the battles above, the battles of Baton Rouge and above Baton Rouge, and then moving up the river to meet up with Grant's forces coming down, kind of situation. So Farragut wasn't going to be the occupying command. Butler is an interesting way to start that, because again, he's a politician. He's got the skills to do this, but also he's got the army training to just do this the way it should be done from an army perspective. Now, the idea there is that, you know, basically there's just ways you can come in. You know, throughout history, occupying armies just have different approaches to things, anything from just a, you know, barbarians at the gate and then just rape, pillage, plunder, to something a little more under control. Naturally, the Union Army wanted the under control part because they wanted to reopen the port and then use the port, obviously, to split the rebel forces in half on the west, you know, on the western front. So that's kind of the approach there, and so this is it's interesting there. So I'm going to read a paragraph from Butler's proclamation of May 1st. That is kind of gets to the whole point of some of the thought or the attitude here. So thrice before has the city New Orleans been rescued from the hand of a foreign government and still more calamitous domestic insurrection. It has of late been under the military control of the rebel forces, claiming to be the peculiar friends of the citizens, and at each time, in the judgment of the commander of the military forces holding it, it has been found necessary to preserve order and maintain quiet by the administration of law martial. Even during the interim from its evacuation by the rebel soldiers and its actual possession by the soldiers of the United States, the civil authorities of the city have found it necessary to call for the intervention of an armed body known as the European Legion to preserve public tranquility. The commanding general, therefore, will cause the city to be governed until the restoration of municipal authority and his further orders by the law marshal, a measure for which it would seem the previous recital furnishes sufficient precedence. So basically what he's saying is that Lovell was here. Lovell had forces. He could have done something. They turn tail and left and bailed up to Camp Moore. They, you know, basically go up past, you know, up above Baton Rouge, and they leave the city to the European Legion, which is really a collection of Creole units who pretty much didn't want to fight anybody. And that was about all that was left in terms of rebel forces. And it's hard to say that the European Legion was even rebel forces. You know, there was a lot of codicils in those militia orders and militia agreements that they wouldn't leave Orleans Parish, so they couldn't get pulled out and integrated into, say, the Army of Tennessee or the Army of Northern Virginia, like legitimate Army units like the Washington Artillery did. So that's kind of the idea there. So basically what Butler is saying in the proclamation is, you know, you people are an unruly lot. And this is true because, you know, it's when Farragut comes up the river, they're shooting at people who are cheering for the Union Navy coming up. There's just a lot of awful people in New Orleans at that point who are angry that they lost. And the immigrants, the Irish and the Germans in particular, are trying to keep their heads down throughout this. And basically the military authority wasn't doing them any good. So Butler just comes in and says, oh, heck no. You know, we the United States Army now is a well-established force. We've got rules. We've got ways of doing things. And that's how this is going to happen. Now, one of the other things, and it's just I'm gonna leave it at this in terms of some of the stories, because as soon as you put up a picture of Butler or you put up a story about Butler, there are all the people who just grew up learning the Lost Cause mythology as fact sit there and they go, it's the Beast and it's Spoons. And the Beast piece, yeah, you know, nobody likes the guy who is just declared martial law in your town. You lost, you're hurting, and now the guy that your army wanted to kill is running the show. So the Beast bit, yeah, that's gonna, you know, that's just gonna stick in the mythos forever. But the Spoons thing is interesting because as part of this military occupation, one of the things that occupying armies do throughout history is loot. But the United States Army looted in a very organized way. And basically what they did was they came in and confiscated gold and silver from the civilian population. So if you had like go, say gold candlesticks, then boom, they were going in the sack. But this wasn't going for the, well, I mean, naturally some of this fell into the personal hands and personally enriched people. But the idea was that, you know, that the gold and silver was going to be confiscated, melted down, and then brought back to the, you know, basically become part of the government treasury. So the idea that Butler was stealing spoons from houses because he was some petty thief, that's not what happened. That's what the story turned into. But basically, he's not stealing spoons. He's just confiscating. They're looting the town. And they're doing it in an organized manner under the auspices of the federal government. Now, you could say he's a terrible person for doing that, but he's not a petty thief. So the whole spoons thing just always kind of gets on my nerves at that point. So anyway, so the proclamation is issued on May 1st, and things kind of go downhill from there with Butler, all the way to General Order 23, which was the one that if a woman insulted a member of the Union Army, she was considered to be a lady of the evening and could then be treated as a streetwalker, as a prostitute in terms of legal and, you know, being told to move on or being, you know, harassed. So the Butler never did really work out. I mean, his attitude was, I am an occupying command. I'm going to pacify this city. He hangs people who disagree, hangs and shoots people who disagree with him when they haul down the American flag. so basically, he's not playing nice, and of course he's not a nice guy. He's a jerk. So within the army sees that, you know, this isn't, you know, as much as he's doing, making the right moves to reopen the port and such, this isn't going to work out. So by December, this is in, so he gets there in May of 1862. By December of 1862, he's relieved of command in New Orleans it's ostensibly a promotion. It's a reassignment. It's not you are doing a bad job and we're going to relieve you, but it's more along the lines of a reassignment. So he's brought back up to D.C. and takes on new duties, and the occupation of New Orleans then continues until the end of the war. Essentially now the war is over in New Orleans. The port reopens, and that's where the story of the war itself, in terms of grand battles and conflicts and glory, just comes to an end. On a personal level, I think there's much more potential for stories in there's real stories, and of course there's potential for fiction, because we're a port city, and port cities are, you know, underhanded dealings and espionage and everything else is rampant. So that's it, but that's a whole different angle. So the proclamation of May 1st essentially, if the surrender on April 25th, if you don't want to point at the surrender on April 25th as being the absolute, this is the end of the war in New Orleans, certainly the proclamation, Butler's proclamation of occupation on May 1st, 1862 is. Go take a look. Yeah, there's just a lot of good tidbits on the May 1st entry. This is, of course, Catherine Campanella's website, NewOrleansPast.com. And if you're on Facebook, it's a Facebook group called Today in New Orleans History. And you want to check that out and go, you know, just go join the group, or just put that into your regular routine, because it's just really good stuff. But the May 1st entry, yeah, it's kind of fun. All right, let's go ahead. We're going to take a break, and then when we come back, we are going to unpack a photo. NOLA History Guy is sponsored in part today by Elysian Fields Press, publishers of Dragon's Danger, book one of the Bloodbound series by Edward Branley. Don't believe everything you read on the internet. Joey, Anne Marie, and David are three teens from New Orleans. They're smart enough to understand this. Imagine their surprise when a dragon's egg they bought online turns out to be from an ancient trading company that sells collectibles and curiosities. Suddenly, it's more than just kidding around as they help their dragon avoid danger and evolve to its full potential. The Bloodbound series, Dragon's Danger, and its sequel, Dragon's Discovery, are young adult novels written by Edward Branley. They're set in New Orleans, and the age range for these novels runs anywhere from about 12 years old to adult, because it's young adult fiction. The novels are basically about the story of three 16-year-old high school students. So they're basically a bit PG in terms of language, if that's a problem for parents who are discerning what, you know, their preteens should read, then yeah, you might want to consider that. But certainly they're solid young adult fiction. They're available online at Amazon in paperback and for Kindle. They're also available in a number of local bookstores, most notably Blue Cypress Books up on Oak Street. And there are also signed copies of the series are available at ElysianFieldsPress.com. That's all one word, ElysianFieldsPress.com. A photo this today. It's becoming our regular thing to do. And the photo is, well, imagine that. It's a streetcar. But you guys know that's a business thing as well as a passion as far as I'm concerned. This particular photo comes from an online friend who one of these days I am gonna, you know, hunt you down, Aaron Handy the Third, and actually meet you in person. But it's the caption that Aaron put on the photo is inbound Nopsey streetcar 865 (parentheses scrap June 15th, 1964) hangs that left on the Charlie line at the corner of St. Charles and South Carrollton Avenue in September of 1960. She would later become the lone car of the 800 class fleet to be endowed with a fresh paint job. And if I remember correctly, Earl Hampton has a story about why that particular car did get a fresh paint job, and I'll have to look it up. But in any case, it's just the notion of Earl having a story reminds me to point out that that Earl's book, The Streetcars of New Orleans, where he picks up from 1965 to the present, picking up where Hennick and Charlton leave off, is a wonderful read, and it's a must resource for anybody that's doing serious research onto New Orleans history, even if transit isn't your main thing. But anyway, okay, so Aaron gets these great finds. You know, it's Aaron's one of these guys that he and Earl and Streetcar Mike are all scouring eBay for slides and original photos and that kind of thing of stuff New Orleans transit related stuff. And so this is a shot from September of 1960. The palm trees at Riverbend are just gorgeous, and you guys know it is one of the, I think that's probably the thing that drew me to the photo, because, well, let's face it, it's not like I don't have photos of streetcars making the turn from Carrollton to St. Charles. But the palm trees in this picture are really, really nice. And you guys, if you're from New Orleans, you understand the love-hate relationship that the city has with palm trees. We love the darn things. We like the idea of being able to walk around and kind of think we're some sort of tropical paradise. But we're not a tropical paradise. We're a semi-tropical paradise. And sometimes the semi and semi-tropical means it gets cold. And when it gets cold, the palm trees freeze and boom, next thing you know. And we're crazy, right? We just keep coming back and coming back. We're never going to, it seems like we're never going to get palm trees that get to the heights of like what you see in Los Angeles and stuff like that. But we try. We keep at it, right? We don't give up. We, you know, the palm trees freeze and we plant more. So this is 1960. There's some really good, you know, really decent sized palm trees in the photo. Now, to set the stage here, okay, it's an inbound run, so that means that the Charlie car, and that's the old Nopsey nickname for the Charlie line or a streetcar on the St. Charles line, you know, it's running on that line, would be referred to as a Charlie car. So the Charlie car is, has, it's finished, it's gone as far as it can on South Carrollton Avenue, and it's hit the curve. And so it's curving from South Carrollton onto St. Charles, and catches it right in that turn. Now, if you've ever come off of Leake Avenue, which, you know, basically the River Road side of St. Charles, you know, where you make the right turn onto St. Charles and you go past Cuda Brown's and you get to basically where the photographer is standing here, you know that this area is just a pain in the butt because the streetcar, of course, has the right of way. But then so does the traffic that's crossing on St. Charles Avenue. So you kind of, you know, you're in a car, right, like right where this picture, where this photo is, and you're kind of having to, you got to be real careful because you got to judge, and it's like, you know, don't take a chance with a streetcar because the streetcar always wins between streetcar and automobile. And then, of course, there could be a car coming right behind the streetcar while you're caught by the excitement of street rail going by that you don't see the car coming up right behind him, and yeah, next thing you know, boom, now you're in an accident. So it's kind of a tricky corner in that respect. Oh, and you also have the outbound streetcar that's coming from the other side. So while you're looking at this guy coming up at you, there could be another one right on the other side just off the frame to the right. So from a traffic standpoint, yeah, this corner can be a challenge. But it's one of the nicer, more fun places in the city. For a kid who was, you know, I always, as you know, I grew up in Gentilly and slept in Metairie. Uptown was kind of I don't want to say an exotic place, but it was Uptown was just a different place for me. We kind of periodically went uptown, you know, like for equations matches against De La Salle, and then I'd ride the outbound streetcar to I'd ride the outbound streetcar to Carrollton and Claiborne, jump the two-lane bus, jump the Louisiana bus. I'd be at Metairie Road under the overpass and then take the Vets bus home. But, you know, so it was just riding past, you know, basically from Jefferson then all the way through Carrollton was always just fun for me. We didn't, as a kid, I didn't, this isn't a neighborhood I went to. The family would go up to the zoo, and that would really be about it. There was just other things, you know, you go see grandma at the you know, at her house out in Gentilly kind of thing, you know. It's just the way that worked. So this was kind of a different, you know, just an exciting little interesting neighborhood for me. Now when I got to UNO, then of course when you're in college, and in particular this is where for me, joining a fraternity, I started meeting guys basically who lived in other parts of town. You know, we had guys who went to De La Salle in the fraternity. We had guys, yeah, my good friend Steve Wan, who went to Holy Cross and lived in Araby and gave us, you know, gave us Metairie boys some culture, you know, because he had been, you know, you live in Araby, you end up in the Ninth Ward, and you end up in the Quarter more than somebody, well, even somebody from Gentilly, frankly, at that point. So it's kind of that thing where, you know, by the time we hit college, and of course the big thing with coming up to the Riverbend neighborhood was to go to Camellia Grill. And so, you know, the late night pilgrimage to Camellia Grill after being out someplace else and go up and have a chili omelet or something crazy was always fun. So that's kind of part of it too. Now the streetcar kind of obscures the view of Camellia Grill here because the shot is about the streetcar, but you get the idea. The neighborhood was fun. The other thing that was, it goes all the way back to high school, more college and just while I was at Redeemer, kind of after college thing, was just off to the left, off out of the frame, is a one-story building that in the late 70s and early 80s was the Flamin' Burger. And Flamin' Burger was a burger joint. Well, it was a chain of burger joints. For sure, there was the Flamin' Burger in Metairie. There was the one in the plaza at Lake Forest. And then there was this one uptown. And I honestly can't remember if there were more Flamin' Burgers than those three. If there were, and somebody, I'll put it up on the show notes as well, so somebody can remind me and point that out. But of the three, this was the one that we went to the least because, we had friends who lived out in the east, and sometimes we would end up in Lake Forest at the plaza, and of course the one out in the Metries, which is now, that location is now the Mexican place, Coretta's. That was the Flamin' Burger in the Metries. And I know my friend Susie Neuberger likes this one the best because she's a Mercy poodle. And you know, the Uptown girls, you know, would go hang out at this one. And that was always good for us because we could go up and, you know, you're pretty much, well, I mean, by college, you weren't looking at the Mercy girls, but you were kind of hoping that the Tulane and the Loyola women would be hanging out in a burger joint like this. So Flamin' Burger was there. Their thing was a Bud's Broiler style burger, you know, a grilled burger with a secret ketchup-y, tomato-y, barbecue-y sauce. And it was a little bit different. It was a little bit different than Bud's, and obviously it was in a different place than Bud's. You'd have to, you know, venture around to get to a Bud's at this point, you know, in this area. So it was different. It was fun. Now let's break down the streetcar. Let's get back to the actual, you know, let's get to the photo itself for a moment. So this is an 800 series car, and as Aaron points out, this is the only one that got a fresh paint job later, because essentially only car of the 800 series that got a fresh paint job. And because of course by 1960 the fix was in. NOPSI knew they were gonna can the Canal streetcar line. I've got stuff in the book that points back that they were planning this out and making the pitch to the city council as early as 1959. And the big thing there was that the plan was to keep 30 to 40 of the 1923 vintage R-Truth cars, the Pearly Thomas cars like this one. And of course the decision there was to keep all of the keep the 900 series, because while the 800s and the 900s, as they go by, like if you look at this photo, it doesn't, this 865 doesn't look all that much different from 904. I mean, Earl can point out every nook and cranny difference between them, and that's what it's why he's such a great he's such an authority on the Pearlies, but on, you know, on the R-Truths, but the, you know, to the average eye, you don't see something. One of the big differences between the 800s and the 900s was that the 800s, the controls for the door were always were manual. You didn't have the automatic, you know, push a button and then the air brake comes, you know, the air release opens the door, and you know, it's automatic door opening. That, but on the 800s, the motorman, which it was a motorman at the time, still we call them operators now because they're so many women that, you know, are in the union and run the things now. But at the time, you know, the motorman would have to reach over and use a manual pull like you see in a school bus to open the front door. And so it's the little things like that. And from a business and parts and maintenance standpoint thing, it did make sense for NOPSI to keep all the 900s, therefore scrapping the 800s. Now, several 800s have ended up in trolley museums across the country. A couple of them, you know, the two 900s that could be had came back to town for Riverfront in 1987, 1988. So that was good stuff. But the 800s pretty much bit the dust, with a few exceptions of the cars that were preserved in other areas. So this is a common, basically, again, this photo, there's nothing overly uncommon or unusual other than the gorgeous palm trees in the photo. And you know, the fact that this is an 800 car, You could probably go out today, and it looks like it's going to be a nice day. So you could go out today, and you could probably see a similar sight if you sit there at the corner of Carrollton and St. Charles. Obviously, the buildings in the background will have changed a good bit over the last 55 years, almost 60 years now. But you get the idea. You're going to see Archery streetcars on the St. Charles line making that big turn and heading into town. And that's a good thing, you know, just the continuity of it. So it's take a look back, and if you're old enough to remember, because I'm 2 years old at the time of this photo, so you know, it's like this isn't a memory for me. But if you're old enough to remember that time, or if, like I said, if you're like me, this photo evokes memories of basically 15 to 20 years later, when I'm in high school and at UNO, and it still was basically the same, and you had Flamingburger right out of the shot. So take a look back and just enjoy something that's at once a snapshot of a period, but also a statement of continuity, and that's kind of what's fun about some of these old photos. And that's our pod for today. We're going to do a long-form pod either next week or the week after, where I'm going to talk a little bit in-depth about the Times-Picayune newspaper, because with the news this past week of the Advocate acquiring the Times-Picayune, basically what happened was is that the Advocate had to do a WARN Act notice to the state city government that they were basically vaporizing over 150 jobs, which I think it was over like 161 or 164 jobs at the Picayune, that they're just gonna, you know, they're gone, they're fired. So they've got 60 days notice for that, and that was a big shocker this week. So it's going to take me a few days to put together some stuff that I have and want to present on the Picayune. Probably be 2 weeks for that. So we'll do another short form pod this coming week, and then work up to that as we go, because there's other things going on with the Picayune that I want to talk about. So other than that, it's the final Sunday of Jazz Fest. Shorty gonna close us out. Go eat some food, go have some fun, and even if you're not at Jazz Fest today, I hope you're having a great day and that you're going to have a great week. So enjoy listening. I hope you enjoyed listening, and check back on the details on the show page and tell your friends about the pod and tell your friends about NOLA History Guy on Facebook and on the web, and we will catch you next week.